Socialism. We are going through a book. It's titled Socialism, the Real History from Plato to the Present. The subtitle is How the Deep State Capitalizes on Crises to Consolidate Control. And this is our second episode on it. And socialism. Plato says that democracy is doomed to fail because it's based on the people having virtue. And when people give up their virtue, it turns into lawlessness. And then they want someone to come along and fix it. And this person will be all smiles at first, but then they'll end up consolidating power. And before you know it, they're ruling as a tyrant. And he called it a philosopher king tyrant. And he's the head of gold. And he has administrators and military, and they're the arms and chest to silver. And together they make up the ruling class. And everyone else is the abdomen of iron and bronze, and they are the ruled class. So socialism is a two-tiered society of a ruling class and a ruled class. Now, the ruling class, they're above the law, they're politically connected, they're supported by the commoners. The ruled class, yes, everyone is provided for, but nobody owns anything. Everything's owned in common, and it's the ruling class that divvies it all out and dispenses all this stuff. And it is a saying, he who holds the purse strings has the power. So everybody's equal, great. But who decides who gets what? And that person that's doing the dispensing of the stuff, they're going to be tempted to slip a little extra to their family and friends on the side. And they're going to be tempted to want to hold back some from people they don't like. And before you know it, it gets discretionary. And the concept is the person that's dictating who gets what is essentially the dictator. So every attempt at everybody ruling everything equally, no matter how good it sounds on a chalkboard, when it actually gets put into application, it ends up being a dictatorship. So the ruled class, everybody owns everything in common, which effectively means they don't own anything. There are no families in Plato's perfect society. The government decides who gets to have children. And then the government takes the children away from the parents and brings them into the city and indoctrinates them. Now, we saw this in Sparta, especially. It was a Greek city-state. And yes, they would take the children away from the families, and the children were raised in these military schools, and they were taught to be soldiers of the state and so forth. But this idea of socialized is you give up your individuality and you learn how to serve the ruling class. And it's a hierarchical structure. And so Plato explains it this way. He says, when the true philosopher kings are born in a state, they will set in order their own city. Notice he's talking about restoring structure because democracy turned into an unstructured society. So this guy's going to bring structure. It says that he will take possession of the children who will be unaffected by the habits of their parents. These they will train in their own habits and laws. So you want to get the kids at a young enough age before they've formed their philosophy of life, their views on everything. Years ago, I was at a conference with Dr. James Dobson, and he talked about children being the stem cells of the next generation. You think, stem cell, what's that? Well, you have skin cells and muscle cells and brain cells, and each cell has the entire DNA of your whole body in it. But different parts of that DNA are activated to turn into the different cells. But scientists have figured a way to take that cell as soon as it's formed, but before it gets turned into a specific cell, and they can bathe it with particular hormones that can activate different parts of the DNA and actually turn that cell into any number of cells, right? You can turn it into a kidney cell or a cartilage cell. So this idea is that children, if you take them away from their parents and then you can put them in a classroom and bathe them with particular ideologies, these kids will turn into political activists and they will be out there promoting your political agenda, and they won't even know that they've been, their natural growth has been co-opted for a political purpose. So Plato says that the philosopher's kings will take possession of the children who have been unaffected by the habits of their parents. These they will train in their own habits and laws. And these children will be taught lies. That's what he said. He called them noble lies. Plato said, we want one single grand lie which will be believed by everybody. Could you imagine the government taking the children away from their parents and bringing them into schools and teaching them lies? Well, all this information, by the way, is again in the book, Socialism, The Real History from Plato to the Present. And it goes all the way back and traces this through history. So Plato lived around 380 BC, and let's set him aside for a moment. Centuries go by, actually millennium go by, you know, 1,000 years. And so let's fast forward to 1516. And so this is less than 20 years after Columbus discovers America, around that time period. And there's new lands being discovered in the New World. And some of the different philosophers in Europe think about, gee, this new land, we can have new societies being formed, and they'll be perfect and pristine and won't be affected by the centuries of the different hierarchical class structures of Europe. And so Sir Thomas More, he's in England, and he writes a book called Island of Utopia. And utopia is a word that means nowhere. And this island of utopia, this island of nowhere, is supposedly off the coast of South America, discovered by Amerigo Vespucci, who was a sailor after Columbus and who did map making. And so the book, Island of Utopia, is written as a dialogue. That's how the Greeks would write. And so Socrates, the original line of these philosophers, did not write anything down. He has had his academy out in the country underneath the tree, and the students would, you know, listen to him give his talks. But one of his students was Plato. And so Plato wrote these down. And so it's called the dialogue, where it's the aged, wise philosopher is explaining to some young novice the different truths. And so this Thomas More's Utopia is written in this model of a Greek dialogue, a conversation. And the person who's having the conversation is named Hythlodaeus, which means peddler of nonsense. So this island of nowhere is told to us by this peddler of nonsense, and it's a fictitious island again. The thought is, why did Thomas More write this? Well, it was actually a veiled criticism of Henry VIII. Henry VIII is the king who switched from Catholic to Protestant, and those that did not switch with him, he began to become a tyrant and eventually had Sir Thomas More killed. You read his death sentence. It says he would be drawn and quartered and, you know, hung till he's half dead. And they said, we'll be really nice to you. We'll just chop off your head. And so Sir Thomas More wrote this, obviously, before he was executed. But in this criticism of Henry VIII, of him wanting to control everybody's lives, on this island of Utopia, it is perfectly structured. There's a ruling class, and there's the ruled class, the commoners. On this island, there's free healthcare, and there's free identical clothing, and everyone receives free welfare, and there's free meals in monastic communal-style dining halls. And everyone lives in free, identical, three-story housing. And there are no locks on any doors. And there's no private property. All property and goods are held in common in a communal warehouse. And yes, it's the ruling class that decides who gets what. There are no taverns, no ale houses, no coffee houses in this perfect utopia. There are no places for private gatherings. There's no privacy. Everyone is tracked everywhere you go with an internal passport. If you're caught without it, it's a lifetime of slavery. Right? So this is 1516. Sir Thomas More is writing this. and the government decides everyone's careers. And there are no families on the island of Utopia. The government, again, controls childbearing. The government decides who gets to have children, and then the government takes the children away from the parents and brings them into those government schools and indoctrinates them, and then chooses their careers that they have to work the rest of their life. It's interesting that the controlling of childbearing, Margaret Sanger, who founded Planned Parenthood, made a statement. She said, "No woman shall have a legal right to bear a child without a permit." And this we've seen in the communist country of China, where they had a one-child policy, where the government would only allow a couple to have one child. And then after a while, they would say, okay, certain groups of people can have two children, but it's all regulated. And it's interesting that some of the headlines, even fairly recently, there was one published in WND.com, written by Bob Unruh, November 10th, 2021. And the title is, "Parents Warned They May Soon Need a License to Raise Their Own Children." So there was instances where the parents wanted to have a say in what their kids were being taught in the public schools. And the governor of Virginia at the time said, no, the parents do not have a say in what's being taught to their children. And the people of Virginia at that time said enough, and they voted that particular governor out. But we see this push that the government wants to decide what your kids are going to be taught. It's very similar to this socialist plan talked all the way back by Plato. So Plato lived 380 BC. Sir Thomas More wrote his book Island of Utopia in 1516. And then we go another century and we have 1626. And Sir Francis Bacon writes a book called New Atlantis. Now he names it New Atlantis because he's referencing Plato's Atlantis. Right, so Plato's perfectly structured society, he refers in passing to the island of Atlantis and this perfectly structured society. So Sir Francis Bacon's New Atlantis is a fictitious island in the South Pacific, and it's highly structured, a little more scientific careers because Sir Francis Bacon was one of the leaders of the scientific revolution, but the government decides who gets to have kids, and the government decides what careers these kids are going to work. It was so well known of a book, and it was made fun of by someone that wrote a satire on it. And you've read the satire. It's Jonathan Swift's Gulliver's Travels. And you think, okay, here's Gulliver washed up on an island of Lilliput and finds out it's highly structured, with a ruling class that controls every little minutia of everybody's lives, and then the rule class, and they just have to work their jobs, right? And they're being told what to do, and there's no upward mobility. You can't move up the ladder. And of course, the book makes fun of all that. But why is this significant? Well, this was around the time that the Pilgrims came to America. And the Pilgrims were originally a company colony with bylaws written by the investors of the London Company. And these investors wrote into the bylaws that the Pilgrims should have all profits and benefits that are got by trade, traffic, trucking, working, or fishing, or by any other means, shall remain still in ye common stock. And all are to have their meat, drink, apparel, and all provision out of ye common stock. So here are these investors, and they're sitting around a table, and they're thinking about, hey, we get to start a community and a business on the other side of the world, and we get to decide what's going to happen, and say, I know, let's just have everybody own everything in common, right? It sounded good, and they actually referred back to Plato and Sir Thomas More. And so the company bylaws, they tried it, and the Pilgrims almost starved to death, and they decided to scrap it, and William Bradford, who was the governor of the Pilgrim Colony, writes, "The failure of that experiment of communal service, which was tried for several years by good and honest men, proves the emptiness of the theory of Plato and other ancients applauded by some of latter times." I just think this is amazing. Right here in the Pilgrim documents, Governor Bradford says, "This proves the emptiness of the theory of Plato." In other words, the pilgrims knew that they were trying to live out this theoretical structure of everybody owning everything in common, right? So you have these philosophers, Plato, Sir Thomas More, Sir Francis Bacon, and it's all basically a bunch of rich guys sitting around a table coming up with these ideas. And the pilgrims are like, "We're actually going to try this thing out," and it didn't work. Bradford says that the taking away a private property and possession of it in community would make a state happy and flourishing, as if they were wiser than God. For in this instance, community of property was found to breed much confusion and discontent and retard much employment, which would have been to the general benefit. The young men, who were most able and fit for service, objected to being forced to spend their time and strength in working for other men's wives and children without any recompense. The strong man, or the resourceful man, had no more share of food, clothes, etc., than the weak man, who was not able to do a quarter what the other could. This was thought injustice. The aged and graver men, who were ranked and equalized in labor, food, clothes, etc., with the humbler and younger ones, thought it some indignity and disrespect to them. As for men's wives, who were obliged to do service for other men, such as cooking, washing their clothes, etc., they considered it a kind of slavery, and many husbands would not brook it." You're not going to wash that other guy's clothes. And Bradford goes on, "Let none argue that this is due to human failing rather than to this communistic plan of life in itself." He actually uses that word, communistic. He goes on, "I answer that God, in his wisdom, saw that another plan of life was fitter for them. So they began to consider how to raise more corn and obtain a better crop so they might not continue to endure the misery of want. After much debate, the governor, with the chief among them, allowed each man to plant corn for his own household." Wow, what a novel idea. You plant corn for your household. Bradford goes on, "So every family was assigned a parcel of land. This was very successful. It made all hands very industrious, so that much more corn was planted than otherwise would have been by any means, and gave far better satisfaction. The women now went willingly into the field and took their little ones with them to plant corn, while before they would allege weakness and inability, and to have compelled them would have been thought great oppression." Right? So here they tried this theoretical Plato, Sir Thomas More, and later Francis Bacon, this owning everything in common. It didn't work. They went back to giving everybody their own plot of land, and it was really successful. So the idea of everybody owning everything in common was tried in America, and it was rejected. Now, what if older fish could tell younger fish to stay away from shiny things dangling in the water, like a fishing lure? But they can't. So every new generation of younger fish sees this shiny thing, and they're attracted to it, and they're caught. Socialism is a shiny thing dangling in the water. Free food, free clothes, free education, free welfare. Free is attractive, but there's a hook there. You give up your freedom. And now a question. Wasn't the early church socialist? Didn't they like own everything in common? Well, let's look a little closer. No, the early church was the early church. Socialism is counterfeit early church. And the difference is between the word voluntary and involuntary. So the early believers voluntarily sold their property, and they laid the money at the feet of the apostles for the church to distribute. They didn't have their land taken away, and they were forced to put the money at the feet of Pilate for the Roman government to redistribute. Now, voluntary versus involuntary is sort of a big deal with God. It's sort of like the reason that he made us in the first place. Right, everything else he made basically follows laws and rules. There's laws of planetary motion that Kepler discovered, and laws of gravity that Isaac Newton discovered, and laws of pressure that Robert Boyle discovered, and And then in animals, they just follow instinct, right? The little butterflies, monarch butterflies, they instinctively know how to fly down to some valley in Mexico. Salmon, they instinctively know to go back to the river where they were, you know, spawned. And little dogs, as cute as they are, they're following instinct. They were programmed, and we thank God for him making them, and they're cute and lovable. But they, from their point of view, they're just following their instincts. And God made humans different. We actually have a choice. We can say no to our animal instincts. We can make rational choices. And so this idea of God giving us the ability to make choices is a big deal with him. And he made us for this purpose. I get into it in other different writings, but God existed for eternity and everything obeys him. And at some point in eternity past, he said, been there, done that. I can make things that obey me. I would really like someone in my image that could love me. And now it gets interesting because love by definition must be voluntary. And the moment it's forced, it evaporates. And if a guy twists a girl's arm and says, tell me you love me, no matter what she says, she doesn't love him. But if he woos her and courts her and defends her and protects her and rescues her and takes her to dinner and gives her flowers and chocolates and courts her and out of the abundance of her heart it bubbles up, I love you, then it means something. That's sort of what God's after. He's not after submit or I chop your head off. If he wanted to make us submit, he would have made Adam and Eve not eat from the tree. Right? But he gives us this choice, like the children of Israel. He told them, here's the blessings, here's the cursings. It's your choice, but please choose life. And so this choice. So the children of Israel, they go into the promised land, and God gives property to every family. Now, if you own property, you can accumulate stuff. The Bible called that being blessed. And you can be moved upon in your heart to give away some of your stuff. The Bible called that charity. Now, if you don't own any stuff, how can you be charitable? Lenin said socialism is a transition phase from private ownership, capitalism, to communism. So socialism is a transition phase. And Karl Marx says communism can be summed up in one sentence, abolition of private property. So if you don't own any private property, if you don't own any stuff, how can you be charitable? How can you give away what you don't have? What, are you going to steal from somebody else to give away, but now you're a thief and you've broken the law because you've stolen? Right? No. God entrusts you with stuff, and you get the free will opportunity choice to manifest in this physical world what spiritually is in your heart. Right, that you do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And Jesus says, whatever you do to the least of these, you've done unto me. So you get to express your love for God by giving away some of your stuff to needy people. And wasn't he teaching socialism? Well, it's sort of interesting. No, there's a parable of the talents, and one gospel is called the parable of the minas, M-I-N-A, but it's a unit of money. And so in the parable of the talents, ruler gives 5 talents to one person and 2 to another person and 1 to another person. And then he comes back, and the person with 5 multiplied it into 10. And the person with 2 multiplied it into 4, and the person with 1 buried it. And we pick up with that. The one guy says, sir, here is your mina, your talent. I have kept it laid away in a piece of cloth. And his master replied, you wicked servant. And he said to those standing by, take his mina away from him and give it to the one who has 10. And they said, sir, he already has 10. And then he goes on to say, I tell you that everyone who has more will be given, but as for the one who has nothing, even what they have will be taken away. So Jesus is saying that the hand of the diligent shall bear rule, that God wants you to go out and do something with your life, and he'll bless it as long as it lines up with his word, but do something. But if Jesus was a socialist, he would have said, okay, take from the guy that has 10 and distribute it equally among everybody. No, he didn't say that, right? So we try to put some thoughts and actions that Jesus didn't hold upon him that are socialist. Now, there's a confusion as to the role of government. The government has very limited responsibilities in the Bible. God in the Bible clearly gives commands to five groups. The first is individuals. The second is to families. The third is to business, employers, employees. Fourth is to church. And the fifth is to government. So individuals, they are commanded to take care of the poor. Most of the family commands are husbands, love your wives, children, submit to your parents. Most of the business commands are do an honest day's work and don't hold back wages. There are commands for the church to take care of the government. For the church to take care of the poor. And historically, the church has had orphanages and medical clinics. Did you know there's no command in the Bible for the government to take care of the poor? The command to the government's the shortest: protect the innocent, punish the guilty. There's no command for the government to be involved in health care or education or any of that. What's happened is the government has usurped the church's role. Well, that's all we have time for right now, but this information is in a book. It's called Socialism, the Real History from Plato to the Present, and it's available right now at the website AmericanMinute.com, AmericanMinute.com. And while you're there, you can sign up for a daily email called American Minute. So this is an important topic. It makes a great gift to that young person in your life that is going to a school. And again, AmericanMinute.com. God bless you. Thanks for watching.